And I'll begin by reading a poem by Robert Peters from the Mashpee Wampanoag peoples in Massachusetts. He writes, "A red sun is rising, lifting it, lifting the spirits that live in the land. Ancestors emerge from trees and rocks and water. The birds, the fish, and the four-legged ones are watching, listening, sensing the red sunrise. They hold out their hands and wings and fins and rejoice to return to places once called home. High above the noise of civilization, a hawk glides effortlessly. Far below, a lone wolf makes her way through city streets tentatively, while the grass pushes up through the concrete, because there is a small crack, and there is light, and there is hope. There is a red sun rising through the trees and the clouds, up, up, up into the sky, shedding furious light onto the land, sending darkness into shadow, up, up, up until even the shadows have nowhere to go. The red sun is rising. Red people come running, come dancing, come singing, red sun rising. Is it so surprising? We are still here." Beloveds, we give thanks for this day, for the sun, for the beauty of the golden leaves, for friends, for family, for joy in our beloved's laughter, for compassion and understanding, when only tears can come from a broken heart. We give thanks and we think of all the allies that help us through on this journey we call life, the people that make our individual voices stronger and more powerful. So whether you've been coming here for decades or whether you're visiting for the first time, may you find here a welcoming place. Bienvenido, bienvenida, you are welcome. This is a community of faith that is guided by principles and sources that help us answer the call to become our best and whole selves. A call to wholeness and to practice what we call back in First Parish in Brookline, cultural humility. And I have to thank our friend, lay leader, Ann Gilmore Peters, for bringing this term to us to replace a term that we usually find in multicultural diversity trainings that, instead of inviting us to listen and open our hearts, makes us think that we can conquer people's cultures as we might conquer the art of mathematics, for example. So cultural humility is a term that I have adopted because it helps me to retain a sense of compassion and an open heart and a spirit of curiosity, rather than reinscribing colonizers' mindset in an attempt to conquer another people's cultures. I believe that practicing cultural humility can bring us to a place of respect, mutuality, accountability, and a deeper connection with all our neighbors. So I offer you this term today as a point of reflection as we consider our UU principles and sources and continue the ongoing work of building the beloved community. If we are practicing cultural humility, we will envision the presence, the wisdom, and the prophetic words and deeds of Indigenous peoples as part of our UU principles, sources, and everyday lives. As a member congregation of the Unitarian Universalist Association, we are a covenanted community affirming and promoting seven principles that guide us. And they include direct experience of the transcending mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the sources that create and uphold life. Words and deeds of prophetic men and women which challenge us to confront powers and structures with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. In addition to Christian, Jewish, and humanist teachings, the wisdom from the world's religions which inspires us is our ethical compass. It is part of our spiritual life. Spiritual teachings of earth-centered traditions celebrate the sacred circle of life and give us lessons on how to live in harmony with the rhythms of nature. Those of you who grew up Unitarian Universalists and know these principles by heart know what we mean when we mention earth-centered traditions. We can appreciate the meaning of commemorating Indigenous Peoples Day as part of our UU tradition, not as an other or added on. We honor our covenant. So to be clear, we're not just justifying this service merely because the sources happen to mention at the very end earth-centered traditions. The service upholds all of our principles, and most importantly, makes visible the presence of Indigenous peoples in our communities, in our denomination, as ordained ministers, as religious educators, in this sanctuary, and in this pulpit. We are here to share our direct experience of the transcending mystery and wonder, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces that create life. We are here to honor the words and deeds of prophetic Indigenous peoples. We are here to express our gratitude for that wisdom, for those teachings, for the dance. As you may know, the history of this country tells us that at some points in history, Indigenous peoples have been forbidden to dance because it was considered a revolt. It was considered revolutionary. It was part of people's resistance to dance. And so many laws were enacted to forbid and punish the dance that you have just seen, and especially the sun dance. So I bring that in because there is resistance in dancing. There is more than a performance. There is prayer. And there is the conjuring of the spirits of the ancestors. What we have just witnessed here is sacred. What we have just witnessed here is revolutionary. What we have just witnessed here is transformative. I can still feel the drum in my own heart. And for that, I am grateful. Last year, during General Assembly in Portland, some of us had the privilege of participating in a powerful ceremony to practice cultural humility. For the first time, we privileged the knowledge and wisdom of Native peoples, the Lummi Nation. For the first time, we welcomed and honored the Indigenous peoples of the very place we were gathering in, not as an afterthought or off-campus optional tourist activity, but as a meaningful ceremony from the center stage of our General Assembly. Our President, Reverend Peter Morales, greeted the representatives of the Lummi Nation with these words, and I quote, "We are here today to bear witness to injustice. We are here to bear witness to the fact that those with the least power bear the greatest burdens, even as they contribute the least to the consumption of natural resources that has led us to this point. From the early days told in their creation stories, the original peoples of this land have held spiritual and cultural values that honor interconnectedness and promote great care for each other and for our home and its gifts. Yet original peoples have suffered greatly at the hands of those with different values. Recalling our General Assembly in Phoenix, Reverend Morales reminded us that we as a denomination voted to repudiate the doctrine of discovery, a religious decree that is still embedded in our legal system and which has been invoked and upheld to oppress Native peoples and separate them from family, from land, ancestral homes, their burial places. Upon planting a flag, Christopher Columbus claimed dominion over the New World for the King and Queen of Spain. He was empowered by the international laws of Christendom. The doctrine of discovery said that if Christians came upon a land that was inhabited by non-Christians, the Christians had title to the land and should enslave the people. The doctrine of discovery is a doctrine of domination, of Christian supremacy. It said in its interpretation that indigenous people didn't have souls, that they weren't full human beings, and therefore deserved to be enslaved. Today, we recall that GA resolution and the repudiation of the doctrine of discovery and are invited to renew our promise to deepen our learning, build new relationships, and work with indigenous communities for reconciliation, for human rights, and for justice. While in Portland, we learned that the Lumination, their home, the northwest corner of Washington State, is being turned into a toxic corridor by the fossil fuels industry. Right now, the Lumination struggles against the building of the largest coal port in North America in Puget Sound's Sherry Point, which would desecrate Lumination's sacred lands and waters. Muscogee poet Joy Harjo writes, "We've been exiled and disappeared in our own country. A big part of that misty sense of history has to do with the disappearance of fact in the history of how this country came about. How many Native American tribes don't have any of their original lands, or just whole pieces of them. It's a struggle to hang on to it. I think," she says, we are in a kind of exile. Harjo touches upon the difficulty of being Native regarding land rights and tribal sovereignty. She writes, "We were a stolen people in a stolen land. Much of what is now Oklahoma was once, quote unquote, Indian territory. Land that was eventually invaded, forcibly taken, stolen out of Muscogee hands. Hence, even after surviving the Trail of Tears, future generations still had to contend with the ongoing greed of non-Native peoples. Greed was the driving force of the doctrine of discovery to sever the connection between the people and their sacred lands." Joy Harjo's words about being in exile in her own country resonate in Massachusetts, especially within the Mashpee Wampanoag people. They experience their lands being sold in violation of federal laws. There is a story that I like to share about the Mashpee Wampanoag because they adopted me, because they showed me loving kindness, and because they are still struggling, and they are today victorious in reclaiming some of that land that was stolen. So when I tell this story, it's in honor of the Mashpee Wampanoag peoples, especially the elders who are no longer with us on this realm. And in that spirit, I offer it. For 200 years, the Commonwealth continued to recognize the Mashpee's ownership of their Cape Cod lands. The approval of both the state and the Indian governments were required before Natives could sell land to non-Natives. In 1870, the Massachusetts legislature voted to incorporate Mashpee as a town and divide the land into individual parcels. The Indians' common land was sold bit by bit. The state paid the tribe $12,000 in compensation total, but the loss was immeasurable. The Mashpee Wampanoag lost control of their ancestral lands. From the earliest days of English settlement, the tribe was under pressure to assimilate. Missionaries converted many of them to Christianity. As Christians, they were urged to give up Indian ways for European ones, and most did to survive. Throughout the 1700s and 1800s, the Mashpee Wampanoag struggled to balance assimilation and resistance to white culture. Two things did not change, however. They considered that the whole community owned the land, which was available for all members of the tribe to use, and they continued to govern themselves. There was a trial involving the Mashpee Wampanoag peoples in the town of Mashpee. They were basing their case on the Indian Act of 1790, which stipulates that the federal government must approve all transfers of land from Indians to non-Indians. The Mashpee denounced the violation of this act, and in beginning in 1976, they sued the town of Mashpee. They wanted their land back, over 16,000 acres. The lawyers for the town argued that the Mashpee were not real Indians. They were not a tribe, and that they could not bring suit under a law written to protect tribes. The burden of proof rested entirely on the Mashpee Wampanoag to prove their tribal identity to an all-white jury. One must ask, what is a real Indian? The Mashpee presented witnesses that talked about their shared values, their ancestral legends, their spirituality, their language, and their personal family histories. Chief Flying Eagle related his work as elder and teacher of traditional ways, including beadwork, basketry, and other traditional forms. Medicine man John Peters testified to his deep traditional beliefs about his relationship with Mother Earth. But where the Mashpee saw themselves as a welcoming people, taking in outsiders and integrating them, adopting them into their community, the jury saw their Indian bloodline and identity diluted and lost through intermarriage to blacks and whites and the addition of Christian practices to their traditional ceremonies. The lawyers for the town accused the Mashpee of being ordinary citizens who differed from their fellow Americans only in their ability to smell potentially fruitful economic opportunity, end quote. The trial never addressed the real issue of the violation of the laws that prohibited Indian land from being sold without the consent of Congress. Instead, the Mashpee culture, indigenous identity, and subjectivity was put on trial. In the end, the jury found against the Mashpee, disallowing their land claim on the grounds that they were not a tribe and therefore had no standing. The Mashpee continued their efforts to relitigate until finally in 2007, the Department of Interior granted federal recognition to the Mashpee. And just recently, last year on September 18th, the U.S. Department of Interior favorably decided on the Wampanoag's land into trust application, and the federal government committed to acquiring over 300 acres of land into trust for the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. Tribal Chairman Cedric Cromwell called it truly a glorious monumental day. Today, he said, history has come full circle. This goes far beyond economic development. This is about controlling our own destiny and preserving our ancient culture. Now, 300 acres in trust is far from those 60,000 acres held communally in sovereignty. But I think this is a victory to be celebrated and acknowledged. Today we honor their courage. We honor their resistance. We are grateful for their example of continued dignity and resistance in the face of injustice. I'd like to send greetings and our congratulations to the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. We honor the work and sacrifices of Fast Turtle and Slow Turtle of the Peters clan. We honor the work that continues to be done by the new generations, especially the work of Jesse Littledoe, founder of the Wampanoag Language Reclamation Project. She teaches us that reclaiming our language is one means of repairing the broken circle of cultural loss and pain. To be able to understand and speak our language, she says, means to see the world as our families did for centuries. This is but one path which keeps us connected to our people, the earth, and the philosophies and worldviews and truth given to us by the Creator. End quote. Beloveds, Indigenous Peoples Day is every day. Our Unitarian Universalist principles encourage us to seek out the collective wisdom and guidance of the prophetic voices within our Indigenous communities. Do we know our Indigenous neighbors here? Would we like to learn about their history and their struggles and become allies? Food for thought for the future. Our faith calls us to actively engage in the repudiation of the doctrine of discovery as a relic of colonialism, feudalism, religious and cultural biases. It has no place in the modern day treatment of Indigenous peoples. In reviewing the historical theologies, policies, and programs of Unitarian Universalism, we expose the historical reality and impact of that doctrine. We too can resist. We too can be allies. We too can combat the stereotypes and misconceptions about Native American people and nations. Let us together resist by honoring our covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Let us bring to mind and to our hearts the people who are struggling today at Standing Rock. Let us resist by being in solidarity with the Lummi Nation defending their sacred lands. Let us resist by being in right relation with our neighbors, with each other. Let us resist by practicing cultural humility in seeking wisdom and guidance from Native peoples to celebrate the sacred circle of life in beauty, in peace, and in justice. And let us resist by telling and retelling our stories, by rewriting our history to honor the lived experience of Indigenous peoples. All the hands, all the blood, all the voices. We are here. We are one. And as the Lummi people say, shine on, shine on, shine on. Blessed be Ashe.